Welcome, hello, thank you for listening in today. This is, of course, History's Great Mysteries, and I am, of course, your host, Nick. I apologize in advance for the delay on this episode. I've been really, really busy, and I just didn't want to rush it, so I decided to take a few extra days, and here we are, with an episode that I'm sure will not disappoint. I'm especially excited about today's episode, for one, because of the topic, but also, two, it's formatted a bit differently than what is usual for this podcast. Instead of honing in on like one event and explaining all the details around it, today I'm bringing up kind of more of an idea, a theory. And don't worry, it still has plenty of history and plenty of mystery, but today we're going to go more on the discussion side of things rather than just telling. And a warning, the topic today will get deep, like philosophically really deep. So if you haven't had your coffee yet, like I would highly recommend that. You need to get your brain going for this one. And some of you may be familiar with the topic, but let me run you through a little scenario here. Let's say you're going about your day, and you notice something strange, something that's out of place, like the name of a brand that you like, or the words of a song that you've known for years. It just doesn't feel right. Something's wrong about this brand or this song. And you feel like you specifically remember it differently, like that it was spelled differently, that something looked different than it does now, or how a song had, you know, maybe had different words that are now changed from what you remember it. And it doesn't sound like mysterious yet, but what if you mentioned this strange occurrence to a friend and they also found it strange? They say that they also remember that thing like you do. They remember the song like you do, but it doesn't reflect how the song actually is. And then what if you come to find that there are thousands upon thousands of people out there who also share this exact same memory of something that is now at odds with reality? Then perhaps you would think that maybe something bigger and stranger is going on here. Everyone, today I bring you the mind-bending, rabbit hole-creating topic of the Mandela Effect. So let's just jump right in here with explaining what exactly the Mandela Effect is. The term refers to something called shared memory, in which a group of people seem to have a pseudo-memory or a false memory about the same thing. So like in each of our individual lives, of course we have false memories here and there. Memory is a very tricky thing and it can be wrong, especially when memories are, you know, years removed. So, for example, maybe you mistakenly thought that you went to the store and bought something like mayo, right? You swear that you had bought mayo, but then days later you go into your fridge to go grab that mayo that you thought you bought, and you see that you don't have any. And of course, you think back and, you know, you swear, like, I can remember putting my hand up and grabbing it off the shelf. I swear I have that memory in my mind, but nonetheless, it didn't really happen. You never bought the mayo. You just have a false memory. And there's many reasons that this could happen. Like perhaps you are remembering your last trip, two trips ago to the grocery store where you did indeed buy mayo. Or maybe your brain is just manifesting imagery of an event that you really, really wished happened because damn, you really want that mayo. But nonetheless, it's not real. So no doubt the scenario I just laid out has happened to you in some way at some point. And it's not really unique or anything like that. It happens to everyone. But what gets strange is when large groups of people that don't know each other, have similar lives, or you know, talking to each other in any way, they all end up sharing the exact same false memory. This phenomena is called Mandela Effect. And the term was coined in recent years after there was a collective false memory over the famous figure Nelson Mandela. And for those of you who are old enough to remember his life, Nelson Mandela was known for becoming South Africa's first democratically elected president in 1994, where he became a more and more prominent figure fighting against racism and inequality, just kind of a social justice figure. And the false memory comes into play when it became clear that there were a vast amount of people out there that swore they had memories of him dying in prison in the 80s. And, you know, perhaps you are one of those people. This collective shared memory came to the forefront of the public's attention when Nelson Mandela was actually pronounced dead in 2013. And you can imagine what this looked like, right? People were, you know, they flicked on the television to see the headline, you know, Nelson Mandela has died. And they think to themselves, oh, you know, wait a second, didn't he die back in the 80s? And then they go online and then they kind of like voice their confusion or look it up. And then they see that there's a whole group of people that also agree. They say, wait, he died in the 80s. And then people get talking. And then you have this shared memory, right, going, getting popular online, and people start subscribing to that idea. And then lo and behold, we have the first well-known widespread occurrence of this shared false memory idea. And then rightfully so, it's termed the Mandela effect. And ever since then, the internet has been ablaze with communities of people sharing compelling examples of this Mandela effect. So I'm sure you're curious to hear about some of these examples. So without further ado, I will dive into some of the more popular instances, and we can decide whether or not you, the listener, also possess these shared false memories. And keep in mind, there are hundreds of examples online, but I'm only going to go over some of the more convincing ones, some of the more fun ones. So first, let's talk about Star Wars. Everyone has seen the movies, and of course, everyone remembers the incredibly famous scene where Darth Vader tells Luke Skywalker that he is his father. And everyone can picture that scene in your heads, right? So let me ask you, what exactly does Darth Vader say? If you remember him saying, Luke, I am your father, you would actually be wrong. In reality, Darth Vader says, no, I am your father. Which is weird, right? I mean, if you don't believe me, here, I'll play the audio real quick.
He told me you killed him.
No, I am your father.
And this one actually got me personally as well. And it kind of also gave me an appreciation for those of you out there who do stand behind the Mandela effect. Like, it's just crazy to think, why do I have such a strong recollection of him saying, Luke, I am your father, when that never actually happened? Why do I have that memory in the first place? And then the mystery, you know, really comes in when you realize that I'm not the only one that thinks that. Countless others out there have the exact same memory. And obviously you ask, like, how could this happen? How can one, you know, it's one thing to have an individual false memory in your life, but the coincidence, the creepiness, the craziness comes in when you consider that, why do all these people who have never met before randomly have the exact same specific false memory of something that never occurred? It's kind of weird. It's really creepy, to say the least. So let's do another one. How about the 1983 movie Risky Business with Tom Cruise? And, you know, even if you haven't seen that movie, you've of course seen the famous scene where Tom Cruise slides through his empty house in socks, a dress shirt, sunglasses, underwear, and he's singing and dancing, right? I mean, that's a very famous scene. Everyone's seen it somewhere in pop culture. But what if I told you that he wasn't actually wearing sunglasses in that scene? That's right. And this one actually got me too. I definitely remembered him wearing sunglasses. But if you go back and watch it, nope, no sunglasses to be seen on him in that scene. Now, he does wear sunglasses at other points in the movie, quite frequently actually, and he does wear sunglasses in the movie poster, which is an interesting path towards a theory that we'll get into a little bit later. But anyways, yeah, it is odd to say that, you know, some of these randomly strong memories in my mind don't actually reflect reality. So here's another one. Who remembers the old children's storybook series about this, like, sweet family of bears? There's, like, Papa, Mama, brother, and sister. And I know that personally, I read some of these stories as a kid, and I remember it as the Berenstain Bears, right? The Berenstain Bears. They made a little TV show out of it as well. But wait, that's not how it's spelled or pronounced at all. It's not Berenstain. I remember it as Berenstain. I remember it spelled B-E-R-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. S-T-E-I-N. Stein, you could say too, but I kind of just thought and heard other people say Berenstain. And that's the thing, is that it's not just me thinking it was Berenstain, like, throughout my entire childhood, Berenstain. And that's how it looks when you spell it that way in your mind, Berenstain. But you may be shocked to hear that that was never the case, ever. It was never called Berenstain. And if you look it up, you'll see that it has always been called Berenstain. Berenstain, Berenstain, which just sounds completely wrong to me. Does not sound right at all. And it's just crazy because this one is just so randomly specific, too. If it was always Berenstain, why does everyone remember Berenstain, right? You're actually in the minority if you remember Berenstain. I really think that that is the case. And nowhere in my mind do I ever recall seeing it spelled Berenstain. That is just something that is not in my memory at all. And it's weird because if you look at the Star Wars one, if you compare this one to the Star Wars Luke, I Am Your Father one, when you watch the clip or you watch the movie and he says, "No, I am your father," you kind of get this click where it's like, oh, I mean, that's not what I thought was going to happen. But in that moment, that makes sense. Like, okay, I'm starting to get my memory back. "No, I am your father" does kind of sound right. Maybe I'm just a little bit confused. And then you can kind of make sense of the entire thing through that logic. But this one, not at all. I have never seen, heard Berenstain. It just irks. It's like nails on a chalkboard. That can't be right. But it is. Okay, so let's go again. How about a more modern one for the younger listeners out there? Fruit of the Loom, right? It's this popular brand of underwear. There's a very famous kind of logo attached with it, right? It's on all the underwear. Fruit of the Loom. So like, picture that logo right now in your head. What do you see? It's a collection of colorful fruits, right? An apple in the middle. There's some grapes in there somewhere. And it's all spilling out of this straw cornucopia behind it, right? Well, apparently not. Apparently there has never been a cornucopia behind the fruits in this logo. And there are some images online, actually, of examples like these where they put the real logo side by side with what many people commonly misconceive or think, or what the Mandela effect shows. So they Photoshop in a picture of this cornucopia behind it, and you compare those pictures, and you can't help but to think, like, okay, the one that's not real actually looks more like what my memory would indicate, right? And to be honest, it was one of those two where it's like, if you look at the cornucopia image without seeing the real image, you'd say, yeah, that's definitely the Fruit of the Loom logo. So it's just kind of like a really small mix-up when it comes to this one. But it's definitely something that, you know, I didn't commit Fruit of the Loom logo to like my long-term concrete memory. I wasn't like sitting around like, I have to memorize this logo. So this one's a little bit of a, you know, okay, I can understand why maybe I don't have a strong memory of what the logo actually looked like, but it's a little bit weird nonetheless. Okay, so let's just jump into a rapid-fire session of examples of the Mandela Effect. The Monopoly Man on the front of the game box in the middle of the game board, many people remember him wearing a monocle over one eye, but no, he's never worn a monocle. Jif Peanut Butter, spelled J-I-F, apparently some swear that at one point it was Jiffy, not just Jif. The Space Shuttle Challenger explosion, the tragedy that happened in the 80s, some insist that it exploded in the year 1984, but in reality, you know, if you look it up, you see that it exploded in 1986, so this is one where the year is just getting mixed up. The famous line in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, "Mirror, mirror on the wall," that was actually never said in the movie. Instead, she says, "Magic mirror on the wall." There are many out there that claim the woman in the famous Mona Lisa painting used to have a more obvious smile, but over the years, her smile has lessened and lessened. The Oscar Mayer hot dog brand is actually spelled with an A, like Oscar Mayer, not with two E's in it, which is kind of weird for me to look at. The famous cartoons, the Looney Tunes, is spelled like T-U-N-E-S, tunes as in like a musical tune, and not tunes with two O's, as you would spell cartoon, which is, I don't know why they did it that way, but I suppose. How about that famous creepy line that Hannibal Lecter says in Silence of the Lambs? Everyone knows, "Hello, Clarice." Well, evidently, he never actually said that in the movie. Instead, all he said was, "Good morning." And list of Mandela Effect examples go on and on. There are hundreds online, and if they really interest you, you should go ahead and look more of them up and see which of these false memories do you share? And as I've said, I've just kind of said more of the popular ones. And when it came to these examples that I gave, I really did have mixed feelings for some of them, like the Berenstain Bears and Luke, I Am Your Father. I was kind of mesmerized. I definitely had that same false memory that's very strong in my mind. But on others, I really couldn't be sure what looked or sounded more right, like Through the Loom logo or Jif versus Jiffy. And some of them I just had no memory whatsoever, false or true, like the Space Challenger explosion year, which, you know, quite simply, I wasn't alive yet to have made any memory in that regard. So when I first looked at these examples and my reactions to them, I immediately wanted to dive deeper into the why. Why is it that I and many other people across the world have these incorrect memories about something? Is it easily explainable? Or is there something maybe otherworldly or metaphysical going on here? How is it possible? So thus, I delved into all of the possible explanations that I could find. The first approach to this is through a purely psychological standpoint. And so from various sources, it seems that many sociologists and psychologists have studied the phenomena. When they do study it, they kind of land on a combination of something called confabulation, suggestibility, and false memory. Now, suggestibility is exactly what it sounds like, right? It's the human mind being suggested towards something. And as we know, the human mind is a wildly suggestible and agreeable thing. We as humans are often intrinsically motivated to be agreeable. It's in our nature. And when someone comes forward all eagerly and says, hey, it's Jiffy, right? Not Jif. It's never been Jif. Who could have ever thought that it was Jif? And you're standing there, having spent very little time thinking about the names and spellings of peanut butter brands in your life, and you might take this and think, you know, think like, oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think it was Jiffy. And this is textbook suggestibility, right? Firstly, this friend came to you and immediately presented you with the alternative. If this friend just asked, like, hey, has it always been Jif? Was it ever another name? Perhaps you wouldn't immediately respond with, yeah, of course, Jiffy. You might have thought, okay, maybe it was Jif with a G or Jippy. Who knows? But when you see a bunch of people online agreeing with each other, showing examples complete with Photoshopped images displaying the mistaken memory, then perhaps seeing this, you could easily be swayed to believe right alongside them. Out of an abundance of curiosity and determination here, I thought to myself, what would happen if I asked someone what their memory was when it came to some of these examples? If I didn't predispose them and suggest to them the right answer in my question? Like, it would even be better if I could ask someone that was a bit older than myself who could recall these older examples while not also not being privy to the modern idea of the Mandela effect. I wanted this perfect storm to be able to test out this theory of, like, what if I didn't suggest? What if they had the real memories that they could draw upon and didn't know that I was asking them about the Mandela effect? And I thought this was perfect. And so this last weekend, I was actually on a trip with my parents, and I thought, you know what? Why not? They are exactly what I'm looking for. So I went ahead and turned my parents into my little guinea pigs, and I gave them an interview. I was determined to ask them about their memories while not giving them any kind of hints towards the right answer or towards the answer that people believe online. And I wanted to see if they shared any of these false memories. And I was really interested to see what they would have to say. So without further delay, let me give you the recording of these interviews. Okay, you ready to go?
Ready.
All right, so thank you for assisting me today. I'm just going to ask you four questions. It's not a quiz, so don't look at it as like there's right or wrong answers. I'm not testing your knowledge on anything. And reasonably speaking, these are also things I'm asking you that maybe you don't know, and that's totally fine. It's more about memory. What do you remember? And if you do remember something, I want to hear what you do remember.
Okay.
So the first question I'll ask you. The Monopoly Man, you know, on the board game Monopoly, we've all played it. He's on the box. He's in the middle of the game board. What do you remember about him? Describe as much as you can about him, what he looks like.
I remember him having a little tidy mustache. I remember him wearing a suit. It might have been a tuxedo, but a very nice suit.
Okay.
Maybe a top hat. Can't remember
for
sure.
And that's everything that you remember?
White haired. Maybe 60s.
Okay.
70s?
Nothing, yeah. Nothing else no, remarkable about him? No, that's what I remember. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Second question. Star Wars. You've seen Star Wars. You've seen the fifth movie, the canonical fifth movie, where at the end, Darth Vader has just sliced off Luke's hand, and then he's going to make the big reveal, the famous line, "I'm your father." How does that line go? Remember it? Think of the scene. Tell me the line.
What I remember is they're fighting, Luke's been injured, he's mm-hmm. about to fall into this huge cavernous hole on the Death Star. Was it the Death Star? No.
It was in Cloud City.
Sorry, Cloud City. And they were fighting, and Darth Vader said something like, "Search your soul, you know it to be true." And then he revealed, "I am your father," and Luke screamed, "No!" Okay. And then he let go and fell into
the
cavern.
So, in your memory, it's just, "I am your father."
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Number three, the space shuttle, the Challenger space shuttle that exploded. Mm-hmm. Do you by chance remember the year that that exploded?
1980.
Mm-hmm. You think
that was? Yes, 1980. Okay.
Uh-huh. Do you have any, like, specific reason why you think it's that year? Like, oh, I graduated that year or something.
No, it wasn't 1980. It was my sophomore year of high school. So 84.
84?
84. I remember it because I was in my U.S. government class, and it was my sophomore year of high school. I graduated in 87. So I think it was either the fall of 84 or spring of 85.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. And then last one. It's a children book series about a nice little family of bears. I read it when I was really young, but it was kind of like a 90s thing. Many kids would just read it, and there was, like, for a short time, a TV show about this family of bears. Do you remember the name of those family of bears?
I don't. What's coming to my mind is Bear in the Big Blue House.
Well, close. That's the one that's... But this one was specifically a book series, a little book, like flip book series. If I start saying it, can you kind of remember it? It's the
Berenstain Bears?
Is that how you remember it?
Yeah.
Say it again.
Berenstain Bears?
How do you spell it?
Oh, gosh. Berenstein?
E-I-N? Okay. So you remember it, Stein.
Yeah, for as good as I can remember.
Well, it's interesting because you first said Berenstain Bears, and then you said Berenstein right after that, and then you spelled it as you would pronounce Berenstein, right? Or Berenstein, maybe?
Yes, I'm envisioning the word in my mind, and I think it's Berenstein.
Okay. Thank you for answering. It's going to be four questions that I'm going to ask you. But it's not part of, like, a test or anything. There's no right or wrong answers. It's more looking at your memory of things, okay? So this first one that I'm going to ask you is about the Monopoly Man. You know, he's on the box. He's on the middle of the game board. What do you remember about the Monopoly Man? Try in your best, as you remember him, try to describe what he looks like.
He was black and white, colored. I don't recall him being colored. He was a... rich banker type, businessman type.
Okay. What are his, like, what does he look like? What visually, what is he wearing? What is remarkable about his appearance?
It seems like he was wearing a suit. Maybe a top hat. Round face, chubby.
Okay. That's all you remember, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Number two. Star Wars, that famous scene in the fifth movie where he's just cut Luke's arm off and then he's going to reveal that, you know, "I'm your father." Can you think to that exact scene and remember, try to remember specifically, what does Darth Vader tell Luke? Like, what does he say exactly?
I'm your father. I don't remember.
Okay. Okay, that's okay. All right, number three, the Challenger space shuttle that blew up. Do you remember, by chance, the year that it blew up?
No.
No? Okay. Because some people can remember it like, oh, I was in this grade at this, doing this, and then by that they can remember the year. Nothing like that pops up for you?
No.
Okay. No. Then number four, last one. do you remember, it's a childhood like book series that for a time was also like a little TV show. It's about a family of bears. I read it when I was really young. I know we had it somewhere in the house. A family of bears. Do you remember what the name of that book series was? Or what the name of the family was?
Not Goldilocks and the
No, 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 no. But it's a child story, too. If I start saying it, maybe it'll spur your memory.
Is it like the young bear and the older brother bear?
Yeah, it's a family of bears. This okay, specifically, it's the Baron... Does that ring a bell? No? Okay. The results were pretty interesting here, if I do say so myself. Neither of them remembered a monocle on the Monopoly Man or Darth Vader saying, "Luke, I am your father." However, my mom fell into the 1984 Challenger false memory, and she kind of semi-fell into the Berenstain Bears false memory as well, even when I hadn't given her any hints in the right direction. Definitely got me thinking that maybe there is something more to this, something that can't just simply be explained away with suggestibility. So I turned my attention to the second and third term that I mentioned a while back, false memory and confabulation. So false memory and confabulation, two things that go hand in hand. A false memory is something I already discussed, something that has come up before in this podcast before, actually. Witnesses in trials are historically unreliable, perhaps saying, "Oh, you know, the perpetrator was wearing a green shirt, I'm sure of it," when in reality, it may have been a blue shirt. Or how about people's memory of 9/11? It's a well-documented psychological observation that many people have false memories of where they were and what they were doing when they learned about the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. People say, "Oh, well, I was driving to work and I heard it on the radio," or, "Oh, I was unloading groceries that I had bought from Safeway, and furthermore, I remember the specific news anchor I was watching who, you know, and we were crowded around the TV, me and this other person," and in many cases, not all the cases, but in many cases, these memories are slightly inaccurate, and sometimes it can actually be proven that they're inaccurate, like, "Oh, well, that news anchor didn't start working for that channel until 2004, or that grocery store wasn't built until 2006. Yet, nonetheless, people swear up and down that this memory is burned into them, like it couldn't possibly be inaccurate. And it's easy to see why they think that. After all, 9/11 was a terribly traumatic event, one that people feel like they wouldn't soon forget. But modern studies on human memory have been showing time and time again the inconsistencies that can pop up. For instance, a 1992 study on flashbulb memories showed that people are much better at remembering how a certain event made them feel rather than what actually happened in the event. Moreover, a study in Northwestern in 2012 showed that human memory is kind of like the old telephone game. If a memory is old enough, when we go back to try to recall that memory, we aren't actually remembering it as it really happened, but rather, we are remembering the last time we remembered it. And you can see how that could lead to incorrect memories, just like the telephone game. You swear that you heard the person next to you say one thing, so then you relay that to the next person in line, 100% sure of yourself, even if you're actually dead wrong. And that's where confabulation comes in. These are honest lies, right? In your mind, you're telling the truth, because the last time you remembering 9/11, you bought these groceries at Safeway. So upon retrieving that memory of a memory, you 100% believe, yep, Safeway. But the reality of the situation has been lost to you, never to be recovered. So with all of these wonky psychological occurrences, it's not unreasonable to think some of these things could be at play with the Mandela effect. But why is it specifically these things, these examples that I've given, the Monopoly Man, Star Wars, Peanut Butter, Silence of the Lambs, what is it about specifically these past instances that has brought them into the discussion of the Mandela effect? Well, this is where another more logical, concrete approach may be of assistance. And this approach aims at explaining these memories with specifics. Take, for example, the Risky Business example I gave, where Tom Cruise was never actually wearing sunglasses in that famous scene. So think of it this way. In the movie itself, Tom Cruise's character wears sunglasses a lot, and he's wearing them in the main movie poster as well. So it's reasonable to assume that maybe he was wearing them in that famous scene, too. If you don't really, really remember the scene, if you didn't just watch the movie 2 minutes ago, you might just go ahead and put sunglasses on him in that scene as you remember it, right? And going further, it's true that this scene has been recreated 1,000 times, you know, Saturday Night Live, spoofs, music videos, etc., many of which will either purposely, just to give character recognition, they'll give the person in the scene sunglasses, even though they know that's not how it really was, or they might give it to him on accident, and then they'll recreate that scene with the character wearing the sunglasses, and bada bing, bada boom, that's the last thing you remember, and you just assume that's how it was in the memory too, and then pop culture takes it off, and everybody remembers him wearing sunglasses, and here we are, talking about the Mandela effect with this example. And so, really, when you think about it that way, when you think about giving the specifics, these false memory things, they can be explained in some situations. You know, you could explain the Luke, I am your father memory with this process too. Well, it's been done so many times in pop culture and spoofs and everything that when they say it in the lines there, they say Luke, I am your father, maybe to really drive home that they're talking about Darth Vader in Star Wars, talking to Luke Skywalker, right? You know, maybe it requires something like that. It requires this pop culture morphing of our memory to create a Mandela effect. And another even better example is the famous song We Are the Champions by Queen. Many point to this as a Mandela effect, as many people never remember Freddie Mercury singing the line of the world, even though that line does appear in modern plays of the song, right? When we listen to it, when we think about it, pretty much all of us remember hearing of the world, right? That's like the big end there. But apparently there's a lot of people who were around when that album first came out that say, wait, he never said that. That was never a thing. Why is it in the modern songs that play that? You know, why when I listen to it in the grocery store, does it say of the world? And this is actually really easily explainable. In the original album version of the song, he didn't sing the line of the world. That lyric was added in later to the greatest hits version of the song. And if you were to hear the song today on the radio, in a store, at a baseball game or something, you'd most likely be listening to the greatest hits version. So for the people who loved Queen and they were there when he originally released that album, the first album, and listened to the song, you know, they're right. It didn't contain those lyrics. But today, you hear the song, most likely it's going to be the greatest hits version where they do sing of the world, and that's where that confusion came up. And for that reason, this quote-unquote example of the Mandela effect is very easily explained. And you can see how, you know, taking a logical step-by-step approach to debunking these false memories can work in certain scenarios. But what about the scenarios where that doesn't work? What about when there's no real explanation as to why vast amounts of different people recall oddly specific exact memories of something that never existed? Well, then you might start venturing into a more supernatural explanation for the Mandela effect. For me, the most compelling example that cannot be easily explained is the Berenstain Bears. How can so many people specifically remember the Berenstain Bears when no, it was actually Berenstain all along? The previous theories and approaches to explaining the Mandela effect do little to solve the Berenstain example. The closest thing that I've heard is that maybe it's a result of people mispronouncing the name as Berenstain, even though it's always been spelled as Stain. So over the years, everyone just kind of assumed that it was spelled the way it sounded, and now we're just kind of stuck in our ways, which is a bit odd for me to imagine, like, why a mispronunciation could be perpetuated so far out of something that was designed to be read. We had to read it first. It's always been written in print, black and white ink, Berenstain. Like, I don't know how that could be perpetuated so far for 30 years out of something that originally had to be read. How did we get here? How does everyone remember Berenstain? It just doesn't really add up. So anyways, let's just follow along with this line of thinking. We have this phenomenon that's not easily explained logically, not easily explained psychologically, and for those of you who do hold firmly to the legitimacy of the Mandela effect, the next logical jump to explain how this happened is the result of parallel universes becoming intertwined in some way. Essentially, this theory goes something along the lines of there's an alternate reality in which it truly was spelled Berenstain, and that's the reality that we remember, but somehow we've shifted that reality, and today we live in a different reality where it's spelled Berenstain, and that's the only way to explain it, some people say. And that's the only way to explain that we have why we have these vivid memories of something that doesn't reflect the reality that we now live in. And, you know, quite literally, it's because we live in a different reality. And the specifics of where people take this theory can vary. Like, some people believe that we have all entered an entirely different timeline in which everything is the same except for these few things like the Berenstain Bears, the Challenger space shuttle, etc. Another direction is that perhaps timelines slash alternate realities sometimes bump into each other and get jumbled, leading to inconsistencies in where, you know, where we have bits of pieces from different timelines in our reality, Berenstain, and then somewhere out there, someone now has their our past reality, Berenstain, and they're wondering why it's not spelled Berenstain, right? Now, it's easy to scoff at this idea, and on the surface, it kind of just sounds like another fringe sci-fi piece of craziness with no science to back it up. But in reality, when you dig a little deeper, there's actually quite a bit of science to back it up, at least parts of it. The science will often refer to it as the idea of parallel universes, and I'm sure at some point you guys have encountered this idea somewhere in pop culture. But let me explain the applicable science to it. Many experts in the field believe that since the Big Bang, the universe has been constantly expanding outwards forever. But from that initial Big Bang, there are only so many particles that make up our infinite universe, right? So there's an infinite expanse of space, yet only a finite amount of particles to fill that space. So the conclusion comes naturally. With what we know, it seems that the number of possible configurations of particles is limited to literally 10 to the 10th to the 122 distinct possibilities. So the theory goes that somewhere out there, there is a configuration of particles that is almost identical to the configuration that you and I see around us. A configuration in which there is another you listening to another me blabbling on, but the only difference is the pronunciation of Berenstain. Or the timeline next to that, the only difference is the spelling of Looney Tunes. And, you know, with what we currently understand about space-time, the math does seem to indicate that this is a distinct possibility, which is a mind-boggling consideration, to say the least. But you may be thinking, okay, let's assume this is a possibility. It still doesn't explain how two different timelines could get crossed and bleed into one another. And why, yes, this is a very astute observation, an observation that in and of itself has several possible explanations. Some say that this crossover between timelines has always been happening, but we as a species have just now started noticing it, mostly due to the fact that we're seeing levels of communications via the internet never before seen in humankind, right? Where we can share ideas, different groups of people who never meet can share ideas, and this has allowed us to finally notice it. Some believe that this is a crossing of timelines that has just happened very recently, perhaps due to some scientific experiments that are going on. One name that comes up is CERN, an organization based in Switzerland that conducts cutting-edge research on particles, space-time, and the manipulation thereof. Work with particle accelerators, dark matter, the God particle, other scary-sounding phenomenon that perhaps, just maybe, they altered something fundamentally about the reality around us. In 2019, a very interesting movie came out, a movie that was simply titled The Mandela Effect. Now, of course, this movie is a product of Hollywood, full of drama and special effects, but through it all, the movie actually does contain a lot of good ideas surrounding it. It is a good movie. I do suggest a watch. But the most important thing for me about the film was the theory that it contained about why the Mandela Effect. Why do we see the Mandela Effect? Thus far, I've discussed more skeptical theories, including the psychological and logical approaches, along with the, you know, a fairly common parallel universe theory, more on the believer side of things. But I've saved this theory for last. And if you're thinking that we've gotten deep before, like, my God, you have no idea how deep we're going to get with this one. Because the explanation put forward within the movie is that of simulated reality the idea that we live in a simulation. And the examples of the Mandela effect that we saw earlier, like the Berenstain Bears and Risky Business, it's all due to glitches in the simulation. The very fabric of our reality is ones and zeros. And sometimes there are bugs in the system, bugs that can present themselves to us in very odd ways. Now, this idea of a simulated reality is not novel by any means, and not limited to just explaining the Mandela effect. In fact, this idea has been around for quite a long time, sometimes in slightly different forms. One of my favorite examples of this is the allegory of the cave, a thought experiment that was put forward by Plato all the way back in ancient Greece. Essentially, how the allegory goes is this. Imagine a dark cave, a cave in which there are a few prisoners sat chained together, looking at one singular cave wall. And that's all they have ever known in their life. They have always, always just been sitting in the dark of that cave, looking at that one wall. But behind the prisoners, at the mouth of the cave, people will walk by sometimes. And because of the light that's shining in, the prisoners can see the shadows of these people walking by, sometimes with animals, sometimes they're talking or singing. But to them, the only thing that they know is the shadow on the wall. That is their reality. They have absolutely no knowledge of the world that we know. Of course, we know that we are human beings walking and singing songs and leading horses, but to them, all they know is the shadows. Imagine if you took the prisoners out of their cave and showed them the rest of the world, what we know as the real world. Of course, all of them would be in awe at what they were seeing, to suddenly come to the realization that the world is so much more than what they had believed. Perhaps one of the prisoners takes to this new world, learning its ways and assimilating into it, leaving the cave forever behind. Perhaps another prisoner refuses to believe all of this, and he takes it as an illusion, and he would rather retreat back into the familiarity of the cave and its shadows. The thought experiment is a perfect fit for the more modern idea of a simulated reality. What if right now we are those prisoners in the cave, and what we see as reality is actually just a small sliver of the truth? And like I alluded to, the examples of the Mandela effect are simply glitches in the simulation. But it all hinges on the existence of a simulated reality in the first place, which is a hotly debated idea. One of my favorite discussions around this topic actually comes from Elon Musk, a discussion in which he talks about the possibility of a simulated reality as he sees it. So let me play a tidbit of it here for you.
I mean, I think his, in my mind, like the strongest argument for for us being in a simulation, probably being in a simulation, I think is the following. That 40 years ago, we had Pong, like two rectangles and a dot. That was what games were. Now, 40 years later, we have photorealistic 3D simulations with millions of people playing simultaneously, and it's getting better every year. And soon we'll have virtual reality, we'll have augmented reality. If you assume any rate of improvement at all, then the games will become indistinguishable from reality. Indistinguishable. Even if that rate of advancement drops by 1,000 from what it is right now, then you just say, okay, well, let's imagine it's 10,000 years in the future, which is nothing in the evolutionary scale. So given that we're clearly on a trajectory to have games that are indistinguishable from reality, and those games could be played on any set-top box or on a PC or whatever, and there would probably be, you know, billions of such, you know, computers or set-top boxes, it would seem to follow that the odds that we're in base reality is one in billions.
And honestly, what he says makes a lot of sense, and it's kind of hard to not agree with him. I took this idea and I spent a lot of time browsing around for some concrete facts that might point to the idea of a simulation, and I found some interesting things. There's a particularly interesting lecture from Clee Irwin, the founder of quantum gravity research, on clues that we may live in the Matrix. There's a theoretical physicist named Jim Gates who believes that he has found underlying mathematical mechanisms in our world that mirror the way that a computer code works. And, you know, minds were at the implications of that. But I think one of my favorite clues that we may live in the Matrix lies in the double slit experiment. Now, the details of this experiment can get really complicated, but essentially, the experiment consists of a wall with two slits in it. Some researchers started firing electrons at this wall with the slits in it and expected a few things. Just as the real world would imply, some of these randomly fired electrons would hit the wall without passing through the slits, while some of the electrons would pass through the slits and then continue on past the wall at the same consistent trajectory. But after fiddling around with this setup for a while, they started realizing something really, really strange. What they saw is that when they started monitoring the electrons through their flight, they would behave normally and predictably. But when they were not monitoring and observing, the electrons would behave erratically and unpredictably. Just the mere observation of the particles changed their behavior. And just by observing them, they behave predictably, as if they know that they're being spied on and they want to behave like they should. But why does this happen? Why in the world does this happen? And quite frankly, no one has the slightest idea. But the fact remains, these particles behave differently when being observed, which goes against everything we know about our reality, right? Like the old saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a noise? Well, of course, everyone wants to immediately answer, yes, of course it does. But if we were to consider this experiment, who knows what it would do? Like, if just the act of observing something changes its behavior. The Mandela Effect movie actually has a very interesting take on this idea, and that perhaps if we are living in a simulation, maybe the world is procedurally generated. It's a common practice in video games to save processing power, to procedurally generate. I mean, imagine Pac-Man. The game isn't going to have all of its future levels loaded up and ready to go until the player actually has to go and interact with that level, and then even then it only loads that one level, right? A wide-open RPG game isn't going to render a detailed bush and all of its leaves on the other side of the map to where the player actually is. They'll only load that bush in when the player is close and observing it. The world is only full and ready to be interacted with if the observer is nearby, essentially. And who's to say that our world isn't that way? If we are to believe it's all a simulation, of course, but you know, it sounds so far-fetched to consider it, but think of it this way. Reality as we know it, you, me, every living thing on this earth, creates reality out of our perception. Everything that the world is conceptualized and made observable and understandable within our minds. That beautiful, wonderful space between our ears. That is what perceives. But as we know, what we can perceive can sometimes not actually reflect the truth. Just like the allegory of the cave, the prisoners perceived only the shadows for their whole lives. That was their reality, until it was proven wrong, until they were shown the bigger truth. Just like in the movie The Matrix, everything was going a-okay until Neo took the red pill, and then his beliefs were shattered around him. Maybe that's where we are now as humans. Maybe there is a fundamental truth that we don't see now, but we will see at some point in the future. And you know, I've gone pretty far here. It's really gone off on a tangent. But, you know, maybe learning this new fundamental truth could radically change our reality in a way that these examples of the Mandela Effect are proven true. And maybe they're just like a little stepping stone. They're clues to a bigger truth, but maybe they aren't. Maybe they really are just easily explainable and some sort of collective psychological phenomenon. But where do you stand with all of this? What do you believe? I know I've really gone on a tangent with this discussion, but let me just go ahead and wrap it up with where I personally stand when it comes to the Mandela Effect and the why and the implications thereof. The Mandela Effect, supernatural or easily explainable? Well, honestly, what I believe is that 99% of the examples, such as the Star Wars ones, Risky Business, Looney Tunes, GIF, Mirror Mirror on the Wall, etc., they're all explainable in my mind without supernatural explanations. Perpetuations of confusions that have lodged themselves into our collective societies, such that many people can end up swearing by a memory that was never actually the truth. Yes, I believe 99% of the examples are explained through a mixture of psychology, with false memory and confabulation mixed with coincidences and situations where it's very understandable why we have mixed these things up. Like, it's understandable why the Queen song was mixed up, or why Luke, I am your father would be mixed up. And, you know, if we really are mixing realities or seeing glitches in the simulation or something like that, something far-fetched like that, I feel like that it would present itself to us in a more substantial and irrefutable way than the spelling of GIF or Looney Tunes, right? I think that there would be a different way that we see it. And for the 1% that aren't easily explainable, like the Berenstain Bears for me, I can concede that, okay, yes, maybe something more complex is going on here, something that we don't quite understand fully. But to stretch it out and jump to the conclusion that this is proof of an alternate reality is just a bit much for me. And, you know, this is where I want to have an open mind, because yes, I really do believe that an alternate reality, be it parallel universes or a simulation, are possible. I believe it's possible, very possible, in fact. But I would need to see more information and rock-solid evidence pointing to it. But I'm definitely open to the idea. But saying that, you know, I also believe the proof is going to come through in the math somewhere, or some incredible breakthrough in astrophysics. That's how we're going to find out that these alternate realities could be a possibility, not through, in my mind, the current Mandela effect examples that we see and as we understand them. I do think they are cool, nonetheless. They're really fun to think about and quiz your friends and family with, which I highly encourage you all to do. When I originally dove into this topic, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know where it would take me. And I can safely say that I've never spent so much time thinking and researching about the possibility of alternate realities. And this newfound understanding and honing of my beliefs is something that will stay with me forever after researching this podcast. And I hope that through all of this, I've also gotten you thinking about the vast possibilities out there. And in the spirit of this open-ended thinking, I will leave you with a little story right here. As we knock on the door of quantum computing and continue the progress of technology, the possibility of creating a virtual reality that is indistinguishable from the reality we know now inches closer and closer. In some dark respects, it may be a way to continue on with the human experience if all other options fail. Or maybe we decide we want to do it anyways. Whatever the case, the idea of evolving towards a technological, simulated future rather than a future among the stars inhabiting other solar systems is becoming a more real possibility with each passing day. And if we are this close to it, you know, entering our own simulated reality, then who's to say that that is not the path that all distant civilizations take? Some of you may be familiar with something called the Fermi contradiction or the Fermi paradox. And the question is, if there are so many aliens out there, like the stats point to, there's a high probability that there are other civilizations out there. Every math adds up to that high probability, but then where are they, right? That's the contradiction. Why are the skies so seemingly empty? We should have at least seen something out there, right? But we haven't. And if you're to think about it this way, if you're to think about how close we are as humans to interplanetary travel, and we've only been around for the blink of an eye in the grand measure of time, then everybody else should have already been ahead of us, right? But maybe the answer is right under our noses. What if instead of evolving towards the stars, civilizations elect to evolve inward, to create simulations or alternate realities to continue their existence? Could that be the reason that space is so empty? Are we on our way to that same fate? Is the Mandela effect a mere stepping stone into a larger understanding that could lead us to our own creation of an alternate reality? Well, my dear listener, I will leave that to you. And And there we have it, folks. Enough with the mind-bending, and it's time to draw this episode to a close. As I warned you, this episode really turned into something that I've never really done before, off onto a few different tangents and, you know, very highly metaphysical angles, but it was all stemming from the craziness that is the Mandela Effect. And even if you think I'm a complete nutcase now, I hope that at least you had some fun listening to it all. And again, I apologize for the delay on the release of this episode, but I expect to be back on track for a release about a week and a half from now, not this upcoming Thursday, but next Thursday. As always, I have an immense thank you to those of you who listen to me every episode, and for those of you who maybe this is your first episode, I would encourage you to try to listen to a couple of my other episodes, as I promise you they are not all this unhinged. But in any regard, thank you for listening today. I look forward to the next one, and in the meantime, you guys stay curious out there. See ya.